This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Historian Melinda Maynor Lowry grew up hearing two distinct histories. One was the history of the United States of America, the other the history of her people, members of the Lumbee tribe. Although in some ways she realized they were both telling the same fundamental story. Their respective histories are centered on the fight for independence and self-determination. In her new book, The Lumbee Indians, An American Struggle, Melinda combines memories of her own Lumbee ancestors with stories about key periods in Lumbee history. Lowry is a history professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She's the director of the Center for the Study of the American South at UNC. Melinda, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
It's great to have you here. Of course, we've had you on before and you've talked about this, but this is fascinating now because you really are in many ways jumping off from your own personal history to get into the deeper history of the Lumbee people. And talk about this business of sort of hearing two different stories as you grew up. Talk about those stories and when you noticed that they weren't quite dovetailing.
Consonant. I think that my education as a Lumbee person revolved first and foremost around family stories. So both my parents are Lumbees. They both grew up in Robeson County. Most of my family is still there. Shout out to anybody who might be listening. And they really emphasized for me that being Lumbee is about family and place first and foremost. And so the generations of stories, whether it be about the Civil War or earlier than that, about our land being taken in different ways, or even stories of kind of victory, such as when elders ambushed the Ku Klux Klan in 1958. You know, those were all things that were part of my childhood education and who I was that were quite different from the things I was learning in school about American Indians and about American history. So, of course, American Indians in the classroom were left long ago and far away. And if they existed in the South at all, they were removed on the Trail of Tears and never heard from again. And I think it was probably, you know, not really until high school that all that came to a head for me. And but over time, there were some of these defining narratives of U.S. history, like Thanksgiving, that I realized, you know, this is not quite right. I mean, it's to celebrate Thanksgiving as a coming together of peoples is one message, but the way that it's told in school is the friendly Indians welcoming the pilgrims because they thought the pilgrims had a better culture than they did. And I knew from my own upbringing that, you know, there's nobody that had a better culture than the Lumbees. we had our fresh Southern food, our vegetables that we enjoyed at Thanksgiving. And Thanksgiving was a homecoming. You know, Thanksgiving was a harvest celebration. And it was about being together. It wasn't about somehow thinking that somebody was, you know, coming to take you over.
Yeah, and when you often point out that Native Americans, Lumbee Indians among them, were the first Southerners, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Southerners before there was a South, like to say, because, you know, this was a region that was global from the very beginning. We had tribal nations that were distinct, hundreds of them in this region, and they were exercising diplomacy and trade and war against one another well before Europeans arrived. And so in that sense, it was a global society. And then, of course, when Europeans did arrive and this immense change began to occur because of what they brought and what we sent back, that just escalated that sense in which we belonged to an international space. So the South gets carved out of this, you know, kind of biracial identity after slavery, African slavery really begins to take over the economy. But that's not the South that's always existed. And our people, you know, we're here before that phenomenon began.
Well, I want to talk about that, this binary that we're locked in and how this, your book and this story complicates that. But I want to talk, too, about something that so you hear two different stories and it occurs to you that they're not quite the same. They don't comport. At the same time, you thought there were some fundamental themes that are identical. Talk about those.
Yeah. So, the other kind of defining moment that we celebrate in American culture is the 4th of July and Independence Day. And ever since I was a baby, we went home to Lumbee land for Lumbee Homecoming, which is a week-long celebration around the 4th of July. And so the idea that there was no conflict between Lumbees and independents was a distinct sort of shift from the messages I got sometimes from classmates, especially in college when people start to get politically aware and they start telling you that, you know, you and your people are stupid for celebrating the independence of the nation that tried to take all of your land. And so you kind of want to be like, well, you know what? You don't know the whole story. Let me tell you how Lumbees have fostered independence since before your ancestors were here. And so that type of theme, as I was trying to put this book together and kind of frame it and not tell the whole story, but, you know, tell a kind of story that stretches over hundreds of years, that theme was absolutely necessary. It just popped up again and again. And the other one is really justice and equality and the ways in which Lumbee people have understood that definition well before it was enshrined in the Declaration of Independence or other founding documents.
And the story that you tell in your book talks about the ways in which a Lumbee understanding of those two principles, independence and justice, sometimes work out in harmony with what's happening, you know, on the American scene, and often not, and in conflict. And yet the two themes, as you say, are fundamentally and ideologically identical.
Aligned, yeah.
But, well, and there's another way in which you tell this story. You weave stories about your own daughter, Layla, through
Lydia.
Lydia, through this book. Talk about the multiple histories that Lydia has been digesting and the ways in which she's, in some ways, sees things differently even than you do.
Yeah. So, you know, as a parent, I've tried to kind of recreate the upbringing that I had. I grew up here in Durham. You know, I tried to recreate the upbringing that I had for her. And my parents were deeply connected to our Robeson County homeland. They took us there often. We knew our relatives, knew our history and ancestors. Lydia's also had that experience, but she, of course, this is a different time, you know, this is a different social context. And what she learns in school, for example, when Martin Luther King Day comes around or they're ready to talk about Harriet Tubman or the Underground Railroad or slavery in American society, she wants to know, did our ancestors own slaves? And so I could tell her, well, you know what? There's a little bit of evidence that a few of our ancestors did own slaves. They were emancipated or they were sold, we don't know, before the Civil War, you know, before the time in which all of North Carolina became embroiled in slavery. And so questions like that, well, she'll then leap to the Civil Rights Movement and she'll want to know about what do I know about Martin Luther King? And I can say, well, go ask Grandma, my mother, because she was at the March on Washington in 1963. She heard that I Have a Dream speech in person, and she heard the singing of We Shall Overcome in person, and she sang right along with them. And so for Lydia to talk to her grandmother about that means that she'll have a kind of connection to her ancestors, I hope, that is even deeper than my own in a way.
And the Lumbee of, let's talk about too more generally what who we're talking about here. We think about these tribes as fixed groups, but there's been a lot of mixing. What are we talking about when we talk about the Lumbee tribe? Who are they and where are they located?
Sure. So the Lumbees are the largest tribe east of the Mississippi River, about 55,000 people. Our ancestral territory ranges from the James River in Virginia down to the Great Peedy River in South Carolina. Now, before Europeans arrived, there were probably dozens, if not actually hundreds, of American Indian communities that inhabited that area. They spoke many different languages. And so they were trading and marrying back and forth even before there was something known as race or other racial groups that arrived here. After that kind of phase of warfare, disease, and slavery that is so more well known, you know, from European colonization, our ancestors began to really concentrate their efforts on finding a safe place to be. And so that's how Robeson County emerged as the sort of singular or most identified homeland of our people, which actually kind of came from our ancestors came from all over. And then over time, yes, we've adopted and married with outsiders, both white and black, and now, of course, increasingly folks from Latin America as they move into North Carolina. They're part of our community, too. And we form bonds based on religion, based on shared ideals, based on commitments to family. And those are things that are Lumbees get talked about a lot in terms of our mixed racial ancestry, but every American Indian tribe, every American, to some degree, has a mixed racial ancestry. I think for us, it gets talked about all the time because it matters to outsiders more than it matters to us. And we're this, the South has been this binary, this black-white world. And so almost since Europeans first encountered us and started writing about us in the 1750s, they've been curious about the kind of mixed composition of our group, and they haven't known how to talk about it because they really want this region to be just about two different people. Right. And that upholds their power, but we're not about upholding their power. We're about, you know, upholding our own independence, our own self-determination.
Let's talk about some of the particulars in Lumbee history as it sort of overlays on American history. And let's start with the Civil War, because you found out about your own ancestors, one who was a Confederate soldier, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for a long time, my parents or my family kind of intimated to me or to all of us that he was white, that he was not actually Indian. And then I did some research and I said, I can't find any real evidence that indicates that he is actually white. I think he's Indian. And he fought for the Confederate States of America, survived the Battle of Antietam, you know, one of the most deadly battles in that war, and is buried with a Confederate tombstone in one of our ancestral Lumbee cemeteries. And but, you know, his particular story is kind of interesting because his son, and who eventually married my great-grandmother, had a wide variety of racial classifications throughout his life. Whenever the federal government or some local census taker would come in, they would get identified as different races over time, you know, not always Indian, but sometimes white, sometimes mulatto, which was the common designation for us in the 19th century. And that kind of complexity, you know, automatically begs questions, lots of interesting ones. On the other side of my family, I have a great-great-grandfather who was publicly executed for his role in what we call the Lowry War, this post-Civil War uprising against white supremacist control in Robeson County. There was a multiracial coalition of young men who banded together to not only save themselves from the sort of predations of the conservative Democrats and their political aspirations, but also to really redistribute wealth in the Lumbee community away from those who had taken it and back to those to whom it originally belonged. And my great-great-grandfather involvement in that side of the kind of Civil War story and Reconstruction story was a lot louder in my personal narrative growing up than my thought was white turns out to be Lumbee Confederate soldier.
Yeah, well, it also becomes more complicated when you have a government that is locked in and bases policy on a racial binary, mm-hmm. for whom defining individuals as black or white becomes crucial. And if you don't fit that, now things get really complicated. And of course, you can't blame anybody for deciding that if they have a choice, they need to go with privilege. I mean, there's that.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
there's that. And that certainly wraps into my Confederate ancestor story. You know, there's every reason to think he signed up because he was motivated to not identify with his native ancestry. But, you know, nowadays, I think we're really privileged to be able to hear more voices and more diversity of voices to question those types of assumptions.
Tell us more about the Lowry War, because this is fascinating. And it also talks more about this racial binary when even radical Republicans who were in control at the time felt the need to create a false this idea that what was happening with the Ku Klux Klan, which is something they felt they needed to control, in order to show they were fair, they mm-hmm. were going to stamp out this other group, yep. as well, which had a very different agenda.
Yeah. The radical Republicans eventually made enemies of the Lumbees and the Lowry family and their neighbors as well, because they were pursuing a campaign against the Ku Klux Klan to try to tamp down their power. But they also saw the Lowry family as similar sort of, you know, violence-motivated vengeance groups. And it just was not there's a false equivalency there, you know, that is very rich and deserves to be mined. Yeah. But, you know, one of the things about American Indians is and their Civil War experiences and Reconstruction experiences, we didn't have great reasons to trust either side. It's hard to trust the Confederacy because of the obvious ways in which slave owners and slave-driven economies would discriminate against us, but also as free people, not white. But also the Union and the forces of the Republican Party that were seeking to exert control in communities throughout the South were also exercising control over American Indians out West, you know. So at the same time, imperialism is operating in both dynamics. And Lumbees, I think, saw it as their job at the time to protect themselves and to fight for themselves rather than ally simply with one or another group.
Let's fast forward to contemporary times and Julian Pierce. Tell us his story.
So Julian Pierce was an attorney who was a brilliant young Lumbee scholar. He went to college early, went to college at the age of 16. He went to Duke Law School. He practiced law in Washington, D.C. and Georgetown, got further education at Georgetown, came back to Robeson County in the 1970s to open one of the state's first legal aid units. Mm-hmm. So legal aid units, fortunately, are everywhere now, but back then they were not as common, and they were necessary for folks who had no means of legal defense against a criminal justice system that was stacked against them in many ways. Then in the 1980s, Julian decided to run for Superior Court judge, and his opponent was the longtime district attorney, a man named Joe Freeman Britt, who also held the Guinness Book of World Records record for the largest number of death row convictions in the shortest period of time. Hmm. So Joe Freeman Britt ran his courtroom like a jail, and essentially was determined to convict people rather than determined to apply justice fairly. Hmm. When he had an opportunity to run for judge, Julian Pierce stood up and said, you know what, this is not the right thing for anybody in Robeson County. Never mind, not just Lumbees, but people who were poor, people who were not receiving equal attention or equal protection under the law. And so Julian decided to run for that seat. In the meantime, Joe Freeman Britt was presiding over a system that where drug crime was the primary sort of issue on the docket. And so the criminals who were deeply involved in that activity were both Lumbee. They were white, they were black, but all members of the drug trade, everyone who belonged to that, typically, it seems now, were in deep collusion with law enforcement as well, with members of the sheriff's department. And people are finding, investigators since then have found evidence that that type of collusion extended beyond just local, you know, one-to-one sort of minor transactions. Of course, the state has done an enormous investigation of Robeson County since then. Julian Pierce got a lot of attention because of his race against Joe Freeman Britt promised to open up that corruption. And then in March of 1998, he was found dead in his home. And immediately, because of the accusations that he was leveling against the police department and against Joe Freeman Britt, it was assumed that it was a political assassination. Lumbees assumed, I should say, it was a political assassination. But the sheriff's department came and found another guilty culprit, someone who—
Right away,
within 2 days, allegedly committed suicide— before he could even be questioned by the police, actually.
And, of course, the sheriff was also implicated in this.
In this particular series of events as well. So Julian Pierce's family have never accepted the sheriff department's narrative of this death. And now today they're seeking the state to reopen the case. The legislature has passed a resolution calling for justice in the case of Julian Pierce. And people are very motivated to figure this out.
It's a rich and wonderful history. We've only touched on it very, very briefly. Melinda Maynard Lowry, history professor at UNC Chapel Hill. The book is The Lumbee Indians, an American Struggle. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
We got links to our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, you know her from Mount Moriah. H.C. McIntyre is going solo. We'll hear her live just ahead. Stay tuned.